From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
We thought we were so clever when we noticed this when I was a student. That song by The Cure, Killing an Arab. Wow, that wasn't just a kind of post-punk song. That was about Camus the Outsider.
Standing on the beach with a gun in my hand, staring at the sea, staring at the sand.
Camus is not really a philosopher, although he's a moralist. He's a man who is looking for a rule of living.
For him, death is always something to be rebelled against. And we rebel against it by insisting on living.
This is what leads to his philosophy of the absurd. Somebody who loves life, who lived passionately, is condemned by tuberculosis, maybe to die tomorrow.
You know, he's a very dark thinker, but he also sprinkles his books throughout his life with ideas that life is beautiful, that our senses give us something so wonderful.
Albert Camus was born 100 years ago, November 7, 1913. He died young at the age of 46 in a car crash in 1960. But he continues to fascinate new generations of readers. And one of them is Steve Paulson, who produced our show on Camus. It's been kind of forever for you, hasn't it, Steve?
Yeah, it has. Camus has always fascinated me, really, since I was a teenager when I first read his novel, The Stranger, the story of that young man who simply couldn't buy into society's rules and was condemned to death because of it. But Camus is remarkable in so many ways. He was a dashing figure around Paris, the epitome of cool in his Humphrey Bogart trench coat. And he was also one of the heroes of the French Resistance. He wrote every kind of book, novels, plays, political critiques, and philosophical essays about trying to find meaning in a world that had lost faith in God.
And he also was friends with all sorts of people, but especially another famous French writer, Jean-Paul Sartre. Friends, but a complicated relationship too, right?
Absolutely. At one point, they were great friends. I mean, together, they really launched the public fascination with existentialism and what Camus called the philosophy of the absurd. And then they had a famous falling out over politics, over communism. And what's fascinating about Camus is that he remains a controversial figure in both France and the former French colony of Algeria, where he was born. Now, his novels are still what people mostly read in school, but you could argue that Camus' real relevance today is what he said about politics. People are now rediscovering Camus for our own post-9/11 world as we watch the fallout from the Arab Spring and all the political turmoil in the Middle East and North Africa.
And you searched around for several Camus scholars. Where did you start?
In Algeria, where Camus grew up. And it's worth pointing out that his background was totally different from that of his most famous contemporary, Jean-Paul Sartre, who was born in Paris and was Parisian to the core. Camus was always an outsider. I wanted to get a sense of how Algeria shaped him, so I started out by talking with Alec Toumi, a Camus scholar who is himself French-Algerian and now teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point.
He's born in Algeria. He grew up there until 18, and as he said once, everything he writes is linked to personal experience and to the country of Algeria.
And the fact that he was an Algerian and considered himself to be an Algerian shaped his whole outlook.
Olivier Todd is the French biographer of Camus.
He was a war orphan. His father was killed during the First World War when Albert Camus was barely a few months old. And he was brought up in Algeria amidst poor whites. This is something people tend to forget in a colonial situation like Algeria.
And he was a very poor kid, extremely poor. You know, French language, literature, he learned it in the books and in the street. His mother was handicapped. She was half deaf, didn't hear well, and she was illiterate. She could not read or write. What Catherine Santès, that was her name, what Camus' mother did was to move to the city, to the capital, Algiers, and live with her own mother. And she worked as a maid. She cleaned houses when she could find a job and barely made ends meet. I mean, they were extremely poor.
This is remarkable, what you're saying. I mean, Camus grew up in poverty. His only remaining parent was illiterate, and he ended up becoming one of the 20th century's great writers. I mean, it's an amazing story.
Yes, and you add to that that as a kid, he was ill. At 17, he had tuberculosis, what's called the illness of the poor, because the apartment they lived in had no running water, no heat, no furniture. 17, he has tuberculosis, and he gets scared he's going to die. Then in his 30s, the second lung gets tuberculosis. He's spitting blood, and he's really scared he's going to die.
So this was an issue for him throughout his life. I mean, the fear of dying from tuberculosis.
Absolutely. And this is where it leads to his philosophy of the absurd. Somebody who loves life, who lived passionately, is condemned by tuberculosis, maybe to die tomorrow. Plus, he's a bad boy, chain-smoked cigarette. He also played soccer, played as a goalie. He had all the paradoxes of life. As he said, he loved life, lived it passionately.
He moved to France in 1940 for the first time at the beginning of the war, and he worked as a technician on a Paris daily called Paris Soir. But more important than that, that's when he wrote his world-famous novel, The Stranger.
Well, let's talk for a minute about those early books that first made his name, The Stranger, his novel, and The Myth of Sisyphus. The phrase, the philosophy of the absurd, was associated with Camus during this period. How would you describe his philosophical orientation in those early years?
Well, I would say that Camus is not really a philosopher, although he's a moralist. He's a man who is looking for a rule of living. I mean, the basic assumption is that if God does not exist, in Camus' terms, how should one live?
The Stranger was published in 1942 during the Second World War while Camus lived in Nazi-occupied Paris. That's where he developed his philosophy of the absurd, the idea that human existence has no underlying purpose. The narrator of The Stranger is a French Algerian named Merceau, who's emotionally detached, even at the news of his mother's death. Here's a recording of Camus reading the very beginning of the novel.
Aujourd'hui, maman est morte. Ou peut-être hier, je ne sais pas. J'ai reçu un télégramme de l'asile. Mère décédée, enterrement demain, sentiment distingué. Cela ne veut rien dire, c'était peut-être hier.
Mother died today, or maybe yesterday, I can't be sure. The telegram from the home says, your mother passed away, funeral tomorrow, deep sympathy, which leaves the matter doubtful. It could have been yesterday. The home for aged persons is at Marengo, some 50 miles from Algiers. With the 2 o'clock bus, I should get there well before nightfall. Then I can spend the night there, keeping the usual vigil besides the body, and be back here by tomorrow evening. I have fixed up with my employer for 2 days' leave. Obviously, under the circumstances, he couldn't refuse. Still, I had an idea he looked annoyed, and I said, without thinking, "Sorry, sir, but it's not my fault, you know."
The Stranger became an international sensation, but it's always been dogged by controversy. Merceau has a run-in with a man on an Algerian beach, identified in the book only as the Arab, who pulls out a knife. Merceau shoots the man and then fires 4 more shots into his dead body. He never tells us how he feels about the crime, only that it didn't seem to matter whether or not he fired those shots. For some critics, Camus' refusal to name the victim, to call him only the Arab, revealed Camus' own prejudice against Algerian Muslims. It even inspired the famous song Killing an Arab by the British band The Cure.
Standing on the beach with a gun in my hand, staring at the sea, staring at the sand, staring down the barrel at the Arab on the ground. The sea is open mouth, but I hear no sound. I'm alive. I'm dead. I'm the stranger. Killing an Arab.
So what should we make of the white man Merceau shooting the unnamed African? Was Camus a racist? Not at all, says Camus scholar Alec Toomey. In fact, Camus often wrote about the injustices of the colonial system in Algeria. Toomey says part of the problem is how The Stranger has been translated. The phrase, the Arab, should really be translated as the colonized man.
Imagine the south of the U.S., the master killing one of his black slaves. They won't have a trial. Or they will have a jury that will acquit him. And you have the lawyer of Merceau doesn't even claim self-defense. He could have acquitted Merceau by saying, he pulled a knife, I was afraid, so I shot in self-defense, case closed. The lawyer doesn't. The whole thing is absurd. Merceau is not condemned because he killed. He was condemned because the jury heard that he did not cry the day his mother died. That was his real crime.
He didn't show proper grief.
No. He did not play by society's rules. Meursault is a stranger because he refuses to play by society's rules.
Camus' ideas about the absurd resonated with the other great French writer of the day, Jean-Paul Sartre, who was formulating his own existentialist philosophy. Camus and Sartre became close friends, but later their bitter breakup turned into one of the 20th century's most dramatic encounters between two writers. Biographer Olivier Todd.
It's a long and very interesting story. They both met the way writers should meet, through each other's books.
At the very beginning, for several months, Sartre called Camus, according to Simone de Beauvoir, his best friend. And the way Beauvoir reports it, it was a little bit like falling in love.
Ronald Aronson has written a book about the relationship between Sartre and Camus.
He was tremendously attracted to Camus, and he was attracted to someone who had similar ideas, but was also his opposite, in the sense that Camus was the great novelist, Sartre was the great philosophical genius, and they both recognized that they had very different strengths, and that was part of the attraction.
For a few years, Camus and Sartre fed off each other, sharing their ideas and their writing. They were both men of the left, politically engaged writers who spoke out on the great political issues of the day. And that's where the trouble started.
You must remember, some things have become cliches and platitudes today, like the evils of totalitarianism, the failure of communism. But in the early 1950s, when Camus, in his book The Rebel, criticized the idea of revolution, Marxism, communism, violence, when he said that, Camus was practically alone among the well-known writers. Those were the days of Sartre. Those were the days when the Communist Party in France was very influential.
Camus' repudiation of communism infuriated Sartre and sparked a very public debate.
Very specifically, what happened was Sartre was the editor of the most important journal in France, L'État Moderne, and a young collaborator in the journal, Francis Janson, wrote a review of The Rebel. It was a review that sharply criticized Camus' book for trying to escape from history.
The criticism of Camus was that he wanted to stay in the clouds. He wanted to remain morally pure and not sort of get his hands dirty in history.
That's right. Janson sided with Sartre, and when he published his review, Camus was furious. He wrote a reply, and it was a very angry reply.
And a very long reply.
Right. It was 16 pages, a 16-page letter to the editor of L'État Moderne. He criticized Sartre and Janson for siding with the Soviet Union. Then Sartre wrote a reply to Camus in the same issue of L'État Moderne, 20 pages this time, in which he mostly attacked Camus personally. And then Janson included a 30-page reply on top of, yeah.
And what's remarkable about this whole story is this all played out very publicly. I mean, these were two of the most famous men in France, the two leading intellectuals in France, and they were having this duel out in public. And it's almost hard to conceive of that in today's world because intellectuals just don't matter as much anymore. But this was huge back in post-war France.
Right. It was huge. First of all, it was very personal. But secondly, the public debate reached the 10,000 readers of L'État Moderne, and most of it was reprinted in Camus' former newspaper, Combat. 180,000 copies. You might say everybody who knew anything about what was going on, everyone in the know had read about the debate.
And there was a sense that you had to take sides. You couldn't stay neutral in this debate. You had to pick either Camus or Sartre.
That came from the Cold War. One side was right, the other wrong. And you had to choose sides with Sartre or with Camus.
The intelligentsia, on the whole, sided with Sartre and not with Camus.
Camus biographer Olivier Todd.
They both belonged to the same publishing firm, the well-known Gallimard, and Camus felt totally estranged, and he would avoid going into the office, and he would also avoid some of the cafes where he was likely to meet Sartre or Sartre's friends, and he began to be extremely lonely. Notwithstanding the fact that he got a Nobel Prize, Camus' last 10 years were lived in intellectual solitude.
So here's the great irony of Camus' life. His standing as a revered public figure in both France and Algeria tumbled, just as his literary reputation around the world was soaring.
En recevant la distinction dont votre libre académie a bien voulu m'honorer, ma gratitude était d'autant plus profonde.
In 1957, Camus won the Nobel Prize for Literature. In his Nobel speech, he said, "The artist stands midway between the beauty he cannot do without and the community he cannot tear himself away from."
Je le désire aussi, mais il ne m'a pas été possible d'apprendre votre décision.
When Camus won the Nobel Prize, his native Algeria was mired in a war for independence. For the French, it became an all-consuming quagmire, similar to what the Vietnam War became for Americans a decade later. Camus once tried to broker a truce, to find middle ground. He was appalled by the terrorism of radical nationalists and thought Algeria should remain part of France, but he also saw the brutality of the French colonial system. No one could accept his position. Camus was attacked from all sides, so Algeria's most celebrated writer stopped writing about Algeria. He thought whatever he said would only inflame the conflict there. Finally, a couple of years before he died, he broke his silence and wrote a book about Algeria, but by this time, no one seemed to care what he said. Camus died in a car accident in 1960. Despite his literary celebrity around the world, he was practically shunned in both France and Algeria. The French-Algerian scholar Alec Toumi says no one wanted to talk about Camus for decades.
For 20 years, you don't pronounce his name in France, and for 30 years, he's persona non grata in Algeria. So it's just recently. 82 is the first Camus colloquium in Paris, and not until the 90s, Camus back in Algeria.
Even though he is by far the most famous writer ever to come out of French Algeria, no one wants to talk about him.
Yeah, all has changed because there was a civil war in the 90s. A lot of people went back and read his writing, especially against torture, against terrorism, and taking sides with him and saying, well, maybe we condemned Camus too fast. So there is a movement in Algeria of reclaiming Camus, not yet of rehabilitation, but it's slowly moving that way.
Today, 100 years after he was born, Camus' politics are finally getting a second look. His book, Algerian Chronicles, was just published in its first English translation, and critical judgment has swung around. Just about everyone now agrees Camus, not Sartre, was right in their famous quarrel about communism. Camus' refusal to sanction political violence and his basic moral decency are all part of why we still read Camus and why he now stands as a model for how a public intellectual should act in difficult times.
Steve Paulson brought us that story on the life and times of Albert Camus.
It was only when I read the three slim volumes of so-called lyrical essays that I realized how essential the Algerian summers are to an understanding of Camus.
British literary critic Jeff Dyer is one of many writers who've been influenced by Albert Camus. A few years ago, Dyer went to Algeria on a Camus pilgrimage, looking for traces of the great writer and some insight into his own life.
What for Camus was a source of strength is, for me, a source of neurosis. He grew up rich in beauty. I grew up under a miserly, penny-pinching sky in the niggardly light of England, where, for 3 months of the year, it gets dark soon after lunch, and for three more it doesn't bother getting light at all. For Camus, the sky was a source of sustenance that he could draw on at will.
Now, had you grown up with Camus? I mean, was he one of those touchstones for you, someone who has seemed to communicate something essential about what life was all about?
Yeah, I suspect that my experience of coming across Camus was pretty similar to many people's, in that we were doing English literature at school, and then, you know, you become aware of this, something that seems sort of much hipper and kind of sexier in a way, you know, this sort of French scene of cafes and, you know, existentialism and all of this kind of stuff. I suppose also he was one of those people, a little bit like Kerouac, say, the whole group, the whole scene became interesting. In France, Camus was very much, you know, it had that sort of super sort of celebrity quality. So, yeah, immensely appealing and seductive.
Now, when you were in Algeria, you went to some of Camus' old haunts, including the sea. This figures powerfully in some of his fiction. You went out to the Mediterranean, and you have a lovely passage where you describe being there. And I'm wondering if you could read a bit of that.
Sure thing. Matthew Arnold, staring out at the English Channel, thought of Sophocles and the sea of faith that had since receded. I think of Camus and the beauty that each year is pushed farther and further out into the oil-filmed sea. As I continue walking, the sun bursts out again, making the bank of clouds smoulder green-black, luminous over the sea. Perched between the road and the sea, between sun and cloud, some boys are playing soccer in a prairie blaze of light. The pitch glows the colour of rust. The ball is kicked high, and all the potential of these young lives is concentrated on it. As the ball hangs there, moon white against the wall of cloud, everything in the world seems briefly up for grabs, and I'm seized by two contradictory feelings. There is so much beauty in the world, it's incredible that we're ever miserable for a moment. There is so much crap in the world that it's incredible we're ever happy for a moment.
Jeff Dyer reading from his essay collection, otherwise known as The Human Condition. I'm Jim Fleming. Coming up, more on Albert Camus as we celebrate the writer's 100th birthday. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
My name is Mark Rowlands. I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of Miami. I do like Camus. I think Camus is a very, very interesting philosopher. Camus had a great discussion of a Greek mythological figure called Sisyphus. Sisyphus offended the gods and was punished by being forced to roll a huge rock up a hill for all eternity. When the rock gets to the top of the hill, it rolls back down to the bottom, and Sisyphus must start all over again. So, you know, I think most people accept this is a horrible punishment. The question is, well, in what does the horror of the punishment really lie? And, you know, the way the story is usually told, the immense size of the rock is emphasized, the kind of back-breaking labor required to push it step by step to the top of the hill. But imagine a kind of variation on it. Instead of a huge rock, we have just a fairly small pebble, one that Sisyphus can easily put in his pocket. And, you know, Sisyphus picks up the pebble, walks to the top of the hill. When he gets there, it falls out and rolls back down. He must start all over again. It's not clear that that punishment is much better than the original. So why is the punishment such a nasty one? Well, is it because Sisyphus doesn't like what he's doing? Well, suppose he did. Suppose the gods had decided to just sort of mess a little with Sisyphus, you know, or inject a certain chemical or whatever, some sort of foreign agent which makes Sisyphus actually enjoy this task. Sisyphus now enjoys pushing rocks up hills. Does that make the punishment any better? It's not clear that it does. Some might even think that it makes it worse. Now Sisyphus is not only doing this sort of pointless task of pushing a rock up a hill, but he's being duped into actually enjoying it. So all these sort of considerations converge on the idea, well, what makes the gods' punishment so bad is that it's sheer pointlessness. That's why it's such a nasty punishment. So imagine a sort of variation on this theme where there is a point. Sisyphus is actually building something. The rocks don't roll down the hill. He gets them to the top and he starts putting them in. And in the end, we have this magnificent building of some sort. The problem is, well, what happens when Sisyphus has finished that? What's he going to do now? So the idea is, well, the problem with purpose, right, is that, well, if purpose is what gives meaning to your life, then you better make sure you don't accomplish it, because if you have, then your life suddenly has no meaning again. I think it's a lovely way of framing the sort of issue of the meaning of life. What makes life worth the trouble. It's just sort of genuinely, I think, difficult to see what that could be. Obviously, you know, Camus intends this as an allegory for the lives of each and every one of us. You imagine each of Sisyphus's steps is like a day in our lives. And so, you know, we spend our lives doing various things which, in the great scheme of things, just cannot possibly be important. In the end, they leave no trace. There was no real point to them. Each of Sisyphus's steps is like a day in our lives. Instead of going to the bottom of the hill and starting all over again, we leave that to our children.
Mark Rowlands is a philosopher at the University of Miami. Camus ends the myth of Sisyphus with a surprising twist. Here's some of what he wrote. Sisyphus's fate belongs to him. His rock is his thing. If there is a personal fate, there is no higher destiny, or at least there is but one which he concludes is inevitable and despicable. For the rest, he knows himself to be the master of his days. This universe henceforth without a master seems to him neither sterile nor futile. Each atom of that stone, each mineral flake of that night-filled mountain, in itself forms a world. The struggle itself toward the heights is enough to fill a man's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy.
Because I got a fine sense of humor, but she doesn't laugh for my jokes. I think I'll call up somebody intelligent, maybe Jean Luc Godard. And say, how come making her laugh is so hard? I think I'll call up somebody intelligent, maybe Albert Camus. Say, I got some hot, hot jokes I wanna try on boo. Because I got a fine sense of humor, but she doesn't laugh at my jokes.
One of the largely unknown stories about Albert Camus was his friendship with the scientist Jacques Monod. Both went on to win Nobel Prizes, Camus for literature, Monod for molecular biology. They had one other thing in common. Each was active in the French resistance during World War II. Biologist Sean Carroll uncovered the story of their friendship and has written a book about it called Brave Genius. As he tells Anne Strangechamps, no one would have guessed that both Camus and Monod were headed for greatness.
Well, if you had met them on the streets of Paris in 1940, you probably wouldn't have thought much. Monod was a relatively underachieving and old graduate student, and Camus had just arrived from Algeria and was working on a mediocre newspaper. And it was really the invasion of France by the Germans that changed the path of their lives and really propelled them onto future greatness.
So there's the actual story itself, which we'll get to, which is just a great kind of colorful, dramatic story. But there's a subtext that runs all the way through this, which is partly a story about genius, kind of what it is, what shapes it. I mean, your argument is that in many ways, World War II was the catalyst for both Albert Camus and Jacques Monod's genius. Am I right?
Yeah, there's an entry in one of Camus' notebooks as early as 1942 where he says there's an element of chance to the root of genius. And I think he's absolutely right. And there was another phrase I came across from another writer saying that genius was talent lit on fire by courage. And I think that having experienced what they did, that gave them such a sense of urgency, such a sense of purpose after the war, that every fiber of their being was dedicated to their creative work and to their engagement in the world's larger issues. So these were not ivory tower artists or academics. These were people very much engaged in the affairs of their times, both during the war and after.
Well, just to stay with thinking about genius for a minute, that's so interesting because the, you know, the model we've had for so long, the idea about genius is that it's inborn.
Yeah, I think in the case of Camus and Monod, they were flung into certain circumstances that, you know, no one could have foreseen. In Camus' case, it's very clear. It was really almost a matter of attrition that led him to be editor of an underground newspaper called Combat, or Combat. And at the time of the liberation of Paris, it was his job to put these editorials out on the front page of this newspaper. And those editorials, I think, are some of the most inspiring and eloquent writing in the history of journalism. Day after day, in the heat of the Battle of Paris, Camus just summoned the right words. They were anonymous editorials at first, but when the public found out who had written these incredible words, they loved him for it. And as soon as Paris was liberated, he had a pulpit to sort of shape the renewal of France. His editorials went a really unexpected direction where it was not focused on retribution or revenge, sort of settling old scores, but how to rebuild a country based on justice. Mm. He was the talk of the nation.
Well, let's go back and tell some of this story. So we're starting in the late 30s, early 40s, and World War II is going on. The Nazi Germany has invaded France. Paris is occupied. What did Jacques Monod and Albert Camus do? And at the time, they didn't know each other, right?
No, they didn't know each other. Well, I'll start with Monod. Monod, his wife was Jewish. Monod was not. But a series of anti-Jewish restrictions came into effect, and Monod started talking to peers and friends about what could be done. And he then joined the most militant wing of the resistance and rose to become the chief of staff for operations by 1944. And that involved organizing arms drops and sabotage, funneling in money, sending intelligence reports out to the Allies that would guide bombing campaigns. And then he was right on scene for the civilian uprising that led to the liberation of Paris.
Wow. So what was his day-to-day life like during this period? Was he, you know, pretending to go about his daily life as, and what was he then, still a student, or was he working as a scientist?
He was working as a scientist. He earned his doctorate during the occupation, and he was trying to live a double life for quite a while. And he was fairly newly married, and he had a new set of twins that were really born just a month before war broke out. He tried to keep up that appearance of sort of working by day and the resistance by night, but eventually he had to go full-time into the resistance. One of his friends was arrested and deported, and he was afraid that he would be found. So he started wearing a disguise, sleeping in safe houses. He stayed away from his laboratory at the Sorbonne. He was fully immersed in the resistance, and it became a round-the-clock job.
I mean, what would have happened to him if he had been caught?
Well, it's always arrest and torture to try to get information out of you. And then generally, if you weren't shot on sight, deportation was pretty much certain to one of the concentration camps. And so that was the fate of many resistance members who were caught. It was Monod who issued the order to start building barricades in Paris. That episode, which is really what trapped the Germans and really marked the uprising, started with an order from Monod's hand. And there were code words that went out over the BBC for the resistance to know that the invasion was imminent. No one in the resistance, including Charles de Gaulle, was given the exact date of the invasion for reasons of security. But there were code words to say, first, that the invasion was imminent, and second, in fact, that it was ongoing. These were broadcast over the BBC. And as soon as the resistance heard that, Monod and all of his colleagues across the country had organized a series of operations that were going to cut rail lines, block roads, hamper the Germans' movement so they couldn't respond to the Normandy beaches. And they were very successful at slowing down the movement of large German divisions all across France.
Now, so far we've been telling the story of these two separate men and their separate careers in the French resistance, but they met after the war ended and they became friends. And it's such a fascinating story of friendship across disciplines, because here's this great biologist and here's this brilliant literary writer.
Yeah, they hit it off right away because Camus was having the same thoughts about the Soviet regime as Monod had put out in his article. A lot of people were looking to the Soviet Union as a model of socialism, and Camus and Monod were waving the flag saying, you know, wait a minute, folks, this regime is just as bad as the one we just fought during World War II, if not worse in certain ways. And that was not a popular position. That cost Camus a lot of his friends on the French left. So this friendship with Monod was blossoming just at the time that his rather famous friendship with the writer Jean-Paul Sartre was dissolving. And it was over the same issue, which was the right or wrongs of the Soviet Union.
You know, after the war, I want to talk about kind of the intellectual directions both these guys went, Monod and Camus, after the war. Because after all of the horror of the Holocaust, a very common response was nihilism. Camus, at least, rejected that and went in a much more kind of life-affirming direction, I guess you could say. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And I think that's why people responded to him in enormous numbers, which was, I think, nihilism was the easy way, essentially saying there was no point, that really life was futile. And Camus was really interested in the question of, you know, given the gift of life, how do we live it? And his response was, well, we just live it fully, knowing that it's finite. And then he felt that, you know, striving, just the struggle to live a life fully was, in his view, enough to make one happy.
And what about Monod's response to, you know, after World War II? Because I'm thinking it was also in some ways profoundly hopeful. He dedicated the rest of his life to exploring the secrets of life as a scientist.
Absolutely. And I think that's what happened, is that Camus, his writings resonated with so many French coming out of the war, and Monod was one of them. So I think that he immediately embraced this Camus perspective. It was very positive. It was very hopeful. And Camus so much emphasized the act of creation. Of all the things we do in life, one of the major contributions we can make is whatever we create. And so this dynamic between them of sort of creation and art and creation and science, I think this is what they found to be a very satisfying outlet for all that passion they had for life.
Sean Carroll's book is called Brave Genius. Carroll's an evolutionary biologist at the University of Wisconsin and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. We're talking this hour about Albert Camus, who was born 100 years ago. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Albert Camus said there is only one truly serious philosophical question, and that's suicide. Years ago, that idea sparked the single most terrifying moment of Steve Paulson's life.
I was 18 in a college exchange program in Copenhagen, taking a seminar on Kierkegaard, Denmark's own brooding philosopher, and I'd spent the previous year obsessed with a certain group of writers— Kafka, Beckett, Malraux, and above all, Camus and Dostoevsky. They were my guys, those bleak, depressing European writers. One night in Copenhagen, I was sitting up in bed reading The Myth of Sisyphus, Camus' meditation on suicide and why he thinks we should keep on living even in an absurd world. Camus quoting Dostoevsky's novel, The Possessed, talking about a character named Kirillov, a nihilist who thinks suicide makes logical sense. It is for an idea, a thought, that he's getting ready for death, Camus says. This is the superior suicide. Kirillov takes his pistol and kills himself. That night, I played a thought experiment. I imagined being Kirillov. I imagined holding a gun to my head, and I slowly pulled the trigger. And it became absolutely real. And everything started spinning really fast in my head, spinning round and round. Everything was swirling around, like getting sucked into a vortex. And I remember panicking. And I remember if I stayed in that space even a few seconds longer, something was going to snap in my head. So I let go. The whole episode was over in a flash. It lasted maybe half a minute, maybe a little bit longer. I remember shaking. I remember feeling like I dodged a real bullet. But here's the strange thing about that experience. I've never actively contemplated suicide. I've never thought of myself as depressed. Even when I was 18, I was lonely, really lonely at times, but it was never crippling and never felt hopeless. If I had to describe what I felt back then, it was metaphysical pain. There can be something seductive about entering into this pain, at least it was for me that night, when you catch a glimpse of the path you're on, the track that's been laid out for you for your whole life, school, career, success, and how it's covering up some profound emptiness underneath. What if you step into that void with total honesty, without any sugarcoating? How would it feel? That's the question Camus asked. ¶¶ I've lived two-thirds of my life since that year in Denmark. I'm now 53 with a job I like very much, and I haven't felt that kind of existential angst for decades. But lately I've been wondering how much of that younger self is still part of me today. A few weeks ago, I had a long plane flight ahead of me, so I brought along a copy of The Myth of Sisyphus. You know, but it mostly holds up. I mean, there are a few things that strike me as a young man's manifesto, especially Camus' declaration that what counts is not the best living, but the most living, the accumulation of primal experiences. When I was 18, I read that as a commandment. And it's worth remembering that Camus himself was still in his 20s when he wrote The Myth of Sisyphus. The book was not written by someone who's looking back on a long life. For me, the real revelation of rereading The Myth of Sisyphus was to see how completely different Camus' historical moment was. Not just that it was France during World War II, but the whole intellectual climate was so charged. Philosophical ideas really seemed to be matters of life and death. To read Camus is to peer into a world before neuroscience came to dominate our thinking about happiness and depression, about finding the will to live, about how we construct meaning in our lives. I do wonder if today's obsession with trying to explain everything through science gives us a false understanding, as if a science of the brain can fill that existential void. Camus would have found no such comfort. Thinking back to that terrifying night in Denmark 35 years ago conjures up a mix of emotions. Real sadness for how lonely and alienated I felt, but also amazement that a single book, The Myth of Sisyphus, could have such an impact. I mean, for decades, no book has grabbed me with anything close to the ferocity that Camus did. I don't think any book could. There's simply too much life experience that mediates and filters my reading experience. It softens it. And I say this as someone who loves books. I'm surrounded by stacks of books at home and at work. But there's no book anymore that can turn my whole world upside down.
Reflections from our executive producer, Steve Paulson. It's a sad fact that the number of suicides has exploded over the last few decades. Writer Jennifer Hecht has lost two friends to it. Now she's written a philosophical argument against suicide. The book's called Stay. Hecht says Camus, in The Myth of Sisyphus, added a new dimension to the way we think about suicide.
I think that he came to a place where a lot of people had gotten to in the past, but he went just that one step further. You know, he doesn't believe that there's a God that's making meaning. And so the question is, does life have meaning? And do we like life enough to wed ourselves to it?
It's fascinating, isn't it? If he has come to the conclusion that there is no ultimate meaning, that he would go on to say, you have to decide that life is worth living, whether it has meaning or not?
Well, there's a way in which he does see meaning. We even have a line from him in one of his letters to a German friend, which he published in 1943, that said, if nothing had any meaning, you would be right. But there is something that still has a meaning. And by that, he means that life is beautiful, but it's also horrible. And that reconciling that has been the job of many religions and many philosophies. And his idea is to not reconcile it, but to accept it and not try to solve the problem. For him, death is always something to be rebelled against.
He says, in fact, at some point, doesn't he, that the quantity of life is more important than the quality?
Yeah, he's really out there on his own with that one. Philosophy has, from its inception in ancient Greece, been saying that death is nothing to us, that because there's such an expanse of time before and after our lives, we should not worry so much about how long our life lasts, but just to pay attention to it while it's here. And Camus sort of, he says the exact opposite. He says, what doesn't matter is the quality of life. All lives are very difficult. All lives are painful. All lives are struggle. So the value of it is to stay as long as you can and pay attention. That's sort of our one task, is to pay attention.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because so many people had said you shouldn't commit suicide because it would be an offense against God. And he's focusing it down on a more personal level, isn't he?
Yeah. He's saying something that it's true other secular philosophers have wrestled with, that the church and religion in general, also Judaism and Islam, the church had so vociferously ruled against suicide that it seemed beholden upon secular thinkers to say, I can do whatever I want. I don't believe in God, or I don't believe in a God that would care about this. I'm on my own and I can kill myself if I want. And Camus, like other secular philosophers, many of them have said, no, there are other reasons to not kill yourself. You know, he's a very dark thinker, but he also sprinkles his books throughout his life with ideas that life is beautiful, that our senses give us something so wonderful. There's one place where he says that life has a smell like a hot, wet stone, just that our senses give us such beauty that we are to somehow bear with the frustration and the pain and the humiliation of being human.
One of the interesting things in contemplating his or any other's writing on suicide is that he considers it a philosophical problem. A lot of us, I think, would see it as a psychological problem.
I think so. Today we rely too much on a theory of disease, that suicide is the sort of inevitable end of a certain level of depression. And that alienates people who are not profoundly depressed, but who feel, who have ideas of death and suicide. Throughout history, we see philosophers and other kinds of writers say, look, a lot of people have these feelings. It's not a sign of madness or disease to have these thoughts and feelings. And here are some of the reasons that we don't follow up on them.
I think part of the reason this matters to so many of us is that it is a very personal thing. In fact, we ought to step back for just a moment. Part of the reason I think that you wrote this book was because it became very personal for you.
Yeah. I'm a poet, and there's been a couple of very painful suicides in the poetry world. And for me, it was two women who, I got my PhD up at Columbia in history, and at the same time, they were getting their PhDs in the English department in poetry. And we knew each other. And one of them took her life in 2007, and then the other one did it in 2009. And that put me in a role of trying to think about what the secular argument against suicide was, and coming to believe that having faith in life, having faith in oneself, and crucially, having faith in humanity, the secular philosophical world, really what it requires of us is to recognize that life will often bring you up after it's brought you down, to recognize that the people around you are connected to you. We live in a very individualistic age. This is the first time in history that we have more rooms in the house than people. We want to be able to be alone, but it's also very bad for us to be this alone. And it came to me that if a suicide of someone who I know, but who isn't even a deeply close friend at the time, can be so painful and so pull the rug out from under people, then that means staying alive when you're tempted to suicide is a gift you give people.
These two friends of yours, the poets, each of whom committed suicide, a year or two apart, the way you tell the story suggests that the second of these thought about it deeply, perhaps in part because of the suicide of the first one. And initially, she thought that the first had made a sad decision, and then she did the same thing later. Sometimes it makes you wonder whether you're influenced by others.
Yeah, I'm sure that we're influenced by each other. This decision towards suicide is definitely one that when one person opens the door, it changes people's calculus about how to deal with problems, about how much pain is a reasonable amount to be in to stay alive. The response to suicide through history has been so strong, partially because when you lose someone or even just know someone, that you are much more likely to get in trouble yourself. And likewise, when people bear witness to the amount of pain they're in and yet refused suicide, they're also influencing people in a profound way. And we owe each other gratitude for that.
That actually is one of the things that interests me the most, is this commitment to continuing with life when you don't want to. There is an argument to be made, isn't there, that living has responsibilities beyond yourself.
That's right. But it's not just other people. It's also our future self. You can imagine that if you go back several months or several years and told somebody who is going to eventually kill themselves that that's how they were going to end, they would be very distressed by that. That's because suicide tends to be a short-lived, urgent feeling. We've done studies. We see people who are saved from jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. The vast majority of them never try again. And not only that, many philosophers and thinkers of all different types, many artists, have suggested through history that pain leads to wisdom. We wish it weren't so, and sometimes it's hard to see how it works. But living through suffering sometimes gives you an extraordinary amount of insight. You can see the world better. You're humbler and therefore are not looking at the world through your ego. And we have to say to the person who is suffering, this isn't for nothing. Religion's always been pretty good with that, of saying that suffering is something that you can offer up to God in a way. Well, suffering is something that you struggle through to know yourself better. And if you can have in your mind already a conceptual barrier to suicide, you can save yourself.
Jennifer Michael Hecht is a poet and the author of Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. We've been talking this hour about the legacy of the French writer Albert Camus, who was born 100 years ago. So it seems only fitting to end with a few words from Camus. Here's a passage from his notebooks, written in the early 1940s. The consolation of this world is that there are no continuous sufferings. A pain disappears, and a joy is reborn. All balances out. And even if our will extracts from the future a privileged suffering that we raise to the level of a force in order to feel it constantly, there is in that choice a proof that we consider such suffering as a good, and there compensation resides. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you have any comments or questions about our show or a Camus experience of your own, we'd love to hear from you. You can post your comments on our website at ttbook.org or on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter. The handle is @ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Doug Gordon, Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.